This is Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Hello, and welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, The Power Behind the Throne, the hidden voices of political change in speculative fiction.
And today, we're very happy to welcome Sumeya Dawood, author of Mirage and the forthcoming Court of Lions. Hello, Sumeya.
Hello, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for joining us. Now, I will interrupt here, but obviously we want Sumeya to talk to us about herself a bit as well, and say that actually Mirage was one of our first Dissecting Dragons recommendations. So when we started doing the recommendations, it was one of the ones that I recommended because I'd been given an arc and I'd really enjoyed it and I hadn't read anything quite like it before. So
that makes me very happy.
Obviously, I'm very, very thrilled to have you here with us. And I mentioned before we started the show that I'm very close to the end of Court of Lions as well. So
I'm really excited for you to get to the end. It's always really delightful. I've had a couple of readers like finish and then immediately tweet at me how devastated they were, so it's nice.
That's not good.
I saw that. See, I saw that and I immediately went got off of Twitter. So I'm like, oh no, I can't do spoilers. I've got to leave. Okay, so for our readers who might not have read Mirage, could you tell us a little bit about your world and your main characters?
Yeah, so Mirage is the story of a young girl named Amani who lives on a backwater moon, and she's living 20 years after a wave of colonial conquest has taken over her moon and the planet that her moon orbits. And on the night of her coming of age ceremony, she is kidnapped to the Imperial Palace on the main planet to be the body double for the Imperial princess, who is half indigenous and half Imperial. And so the world is based on, it's sort of a sci-fi fantasy fusion of medieval Moroccan culture if they had terraformed a bunch of moons in space, which is near and dear to my heart because my mother is Moroccan. And the main character is Andalan, which is the indigenous population. Well, she's Kashela, which is like a specific ethnic group on the planet. And she develops all of these relationships with different people in the palace now that she is a prisoner and a slave. And so it follows her through a different, more harrowing sort of coming of age than she had anticipated on her coming of age night, on her majority night.
Definitely. One of the things I found most interesting about Mirage was the fact it would have been very easy for you to make the Princess Marim very, very much the villainess. You could have made her quite a sort of ugly stepsister type character and, you know, quite shallow and quite cruel. But you kind of gave her a veneer of that. And then the relationship that develops between the two of them is really, really interesting because Mani kind of claims her own right to be equal.
Yeah, part of it is that Amani is such an empathetic and compassionate character that like there wasn't a way for her to meet Marim and sort of peel back the history of the things that she had experienced and not connect with her. But also I found Marim, it's really interesting because Amani is the main character, but Marim is the kind of character that I enjoy writing the most, who's really like conflicted and really and bitter and like cruel. She's just a lot of fun to write, but I think so many readers have connected with her just because she's like a bad person who's secretly good. She has a really complicated history, and the complicated history is connected to like empire and colonialism and the ways that those institutions now operate on the planet, right? Like she is a product, she's like evidence of the violence of the Vathek regime, right? Because her mother gets forced into a marriage with her father, and she carries that with her all the time, like the complete and total understanding that her parents didn't have like even the semblance of a happy marriage, and that her mother's marriage to Mathis was a concession to what otherwise would have been like the total and complete obliteration of their culture under war. And so when looking at it under that, like imagine being a kid understanding that like your birth is a concession, is an imperial concession. And then I think, that for me made it really easy to write her as a more complicated character with a lot more depth. because I think I would have had to have been a much crueler writer to have been like, well, I don't care about these things. Let's just make her like the ugly stepsister.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's something that does really strongly come across, and I think you sort of revisit this theme many, many times throughout both books, or so far as I've read in Court of Lions, and that's the sort of the erasure of identity. I mean, in Marim's case, it's she's kind of been taught to be ashamed of half of her heritage, and to seek her father's approval, and you know, sort of nothing she does is really going to make him approve of her, because as you say, her birth is kind of a confession. And in Manny's case, it's, you know, she's literally having her identity erased and being made to be somebody else in the first book.
Cultural identity. You mentioned, obviously, you have Moroccan heritage through your mother's side, mm-hmm. is that correct?
Yes.
So is this something which has been, that you wanted to explore very specifically, or was it something that just kind of occurred very naturally as part of the story?
Both. My father's African American, so I'm also biracial, like Maram. There was a way in which, like, there was no way for me to write Maram's story, or at least for me to tell a compelling story, without exploring that. But also, like, it is really difficult to be a child of two worlds, because oftentimes neither world is fully willing to accept you, because we live in a world in which borders now mean something and they're really, really important, even though they're entirely made up. And so, like, I was lucky in that I don't think I ever really had like an identity crisis, but I did encounter often, especially as a young girl, Moroccans who said that like I didn't look Moroccan or I didn't sound Moroccan, and black people who said like, well, you don't really look black and you don't really sound black, you know. And so that as a matter of fact came into Maram's characterization, and like the bitterness at having to encounter that on a really mammoth scale, right? Because it's not just that, like, she's encountering these, like, moments with people rejecting her out of hand. It's, like, an entire planet and an entire government is rejecting her on both sides, right? And that's really defined who she is as a person. And Maram, like, the history of the planet came to me in that way, that, like, the queen had made this concession and she had born this child, and that child was going to inherit the planet. And so, sorry, as part of that history, like, it was necessary that I explore, like, what that meant for Maram, like, what being biracial under empire meant for her, and being biracial in a way in which she couldn't pretend to be Vathek. Like, she looks Kushela deliberately because it becomes a thing in which she cannot, like, she can't pass. So even people who are tempted to pretend that she's of them can't, because she looks like her mother.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. It's a really, in my opinion, really well done way. It's done really well in terms of looking at inherited identity. I really went around the houses with that sentence. I do apologize. So, yeah, other things that really struck me about Mirage and obviously Court of Lions, the choice to have so many women playing powerful roles while their male counterparts, of whom there were fewer, took more passive roles or their action took place off stage. So looking largely at sort of Court of Lions, but, you know, Idris is adorable, obviously, but he doesn't do an awful lot action-wise on stage. It's very much driven by Amani and Maram and by various other female characters. And Mathis is this sort of stern, very, very distant, on a different planet, patrician figure, who you really only sort of see through holovids and things. And yet he's this presence in Maram's life all the way through, someone that she can never really appease. So it was interesting that in something that's obviously deeply political and rooted in colonialism and war, ultimately, that you took the men out of it.
You know, it's really, this has been one of the like most interesting reactions to the books, that people are like, there's so many women and they're so proactive, because I didn't do it on purpose. That's just where my interest lies. Like, I always say, like, I don't set out to write like with like a theme or a purpose or whatever. I write what I like. But the other thing too is that I don't know what you all's experiences have been, but for me, like, oftentimes men are super happy to just sort of enjoy the privileges that are given to them, even when those privileges are not a super lot, because those privileges are always more than the privileges of women. And so I found oftentimes that the people who are most motivated to make change and have the most at stake are women. Mm-hmm. And certainly, like, in colonial spaces, you know, it's the women who are charged with, like, educating the children, protecting them, running the family, you know, all of this other stuff. And so they get put in positions sort of as a matter of fact, as a default, to have to, like, defend their families and defend the homestead and all of this other stuff. So for me, I was like, and I think that really comes through in Amani and Idrisa's relationship in Court of Lions, is that one of the contentions between them is, you know, who has more on the line. And that's part of it is, like, a function of class, is that Amani has sort of been on the front line of retribution from the Vath because she is much, much lower class than Idris. But part of it also is, you know, she has to think about, like, you know, the village and all of these people that she is being charged to take care of and all of this other stuff, you know. And so for me, it was like, of course it would be the women who got together. Of course it would be them who would, like, build alliances to think about, like, how are they going to protect their families and how are they going to protect the future of the children and all of this other stuff, because these are things that largely women are charged with thinking about, you know, and they can't opt out of it the way that men often opt out of it, right? Like, a less stakesy example, but no less real, is, like, now in the pandemic, you know, there are all of these articles that are like, men's jobs haven't really changed. The amount of childcare that they have to do hasn't really changed, and women's burden has gone up by, like, 30%, you know. And that sort of thing. So to me, it seemed natural that, like, these are the connections that are going to form, you know, like, the most fruitful, most productive relationships in my life are with women. And so, like, these are the relationships that are going to form, and these are the people who are going to take the chance and lead the revolution, you know.
That's fantastic. You know?
Like, even now, like, when you look around, like, in North Africa and the Middle East, oftentimes the most, the pictures that circulate the most are, like, women bearing the flags of their countries, right? Like, in Sudan, when the protest started, there was this one image of a woman on a car bearing the Sudanese flag, and that sort of thing. So,
I think a lot of people in the West forget the fact that actually when it comes to politicians and sort of people in power, there are a lot of women in power across the UAE, for instance, in the Emirates and things like that. There are a lot of women who are in very sort of high positions in terms of, you know, in politics and things like that. In fact, I'm fairly sure I saw a statistic that actually shows that there are far more women in power in the Middle East than there are in Europe. So, which doesn't surprise me at all.
I can believe that. And I think some of that probably comes down to the need to strive. So it's not so much that women don't need to strive so much in the Western world. It's more a case of that, I suppose, that there's less friction, and therefore the men, as you say, are more happy to come in and comfortably sit in roles. And we won't talk about the UK government for a moment, because obviously that's incredibly depressing. Suffice to say, neither of us voted for him. But
well, fantastic. It's so much depth within this, you know, within this story, and it's so fantastic to hear you talking about it. Another thing is poetry. Now, I saw an interview with you where you were actually talking very particularly about the poetry that you were drawing on, and actually how you were working with your mother to get the poetry together, because poetry actually has great significance within the story.
Right. So when I sat down to make the world, to build the world, and to do, like, the codexes and the sort of bonkers world building that I do off page, one of the cornerstones of how I world build is thinking about, like, folklore and culture, and, like, how that folklore develops into, like, a literary scene. And the really interesting thing about sorry, Arabic speaking cultures is that, like, anthropologists have this theory that, like, when you introduce the printing press, oral traditions die out because now you have, like, a version, a, like, static version that you can circulate. And that wasn't true in Arabic-speaking countries, and it's not really talked about. I've only found, like, a couple of books that actually talk about the fact that, like, orality never actually died in Arabic-speaking cultures. And I have a theory about this, about why that is, but I'm also not a medieval Arabic scholar, so I'm going to keep it to myself before I embarrass myself. Part of it is that when print was introduced into Arabic speaking cultures, it was used as a script. So, like, we have a lot of manuscripts of poetry and, like, folk tales and stuff like that that are, like, marked by performers. So, like, we know that they were used as, like, performance devices because they have, like, inscriptions that are like, oh, declaim here or change this line so that you're saying this when you're performing and that kind of thing. Yeah. And so that was the function of print culture in medieval Arabic speaking societies. And I thought that it was so different. And I often, one of my complaints about world building in some fantasy novels is that it, like, the world building doesn't look at, like, foundationally how cultures are actually different, and how when you change religion and when you change language and when you change geography, all of these things affect court life. Mm-hmm. Right. So that, like, for example, in the Abbasid court, you could rise in the court solely on the skill of your poetry, right? Like, you could be like a shoemaker's son and then be beloved of the caliph because you know how to do really good poetry. And I thought that was both really interesting but also really spoke to the ways in which like medieval Arabic speaking spaces, courtly spaces, were just so different from how we conceive of, like, medieval European court life. And I wanted to bring that into the story in whichever way I could, which became more difficult obviously because it's like a colonial space that's been changed to be more like Romanesque or more European or whatever. But I wanted some acknowledgement in the book of the ways in which, like, religion and language and literary scene would automatically make this a space that was different and apart from the traditional European medieval fantasy space that we're thinking of when we encounter, like, whatever is imperial or royal in these books, right? Like, for example, there's no landed gentry in medieval Arabic society because everything is desert, so you don't have these, like, enormous feudal farmsteads, and you can't have a barony. You know, like, the most powerful families were merchant families who could, like, cross the desert and do trade and that sort of thing, you know. And so I wanted to pull those things in as much as possible, and the poetry was part of it because I think in the West, and I've encountered this, like, in graduate classes where, like, they just talk about the novel as, like, the default literary form, as in the default, like, storytelling form. Like, obviously everyone eventually evolves to the novel. And the novel is, like, a 19th century artifact that emerges under very, very specific cultural conditions. And there's a reason other places in the world didn't get the novel until after they were colonized. Like, it wasn't a privileged form of literary art until after they were colonized, because the concerns of the novel as it was formed were not cultural concerns in other places in the world. And so for me, that became, like, an opportunity to be, like, most readers are not thinking about, like, what's the difference between a novel and a poem? But I wanted that to be, like, a mode of thinking in the novel, and a privileged mode of thinking, so that there is never a moment where the reader gets to sort of, like, make an assumption based on their experience with Lord of the Rings about the space that they're inhabiting in the world of the novel.
No, I agree with that. And I think including the poetry as you did was incredibly poignant, because you had these beautiful lines of poetry, and quite often they were juxtaposed to quite uncomfortable or even funny situations. So there might be a lot of humour in the situation, and at the same time you'd have these verses of poetry, and they'd either be talking about, I don't know. There was something about the poetry. I honestly don't know very much about Arabic poetry at all, so I'd be the worst person. But the way it captured concepts reminded me a little bit of Japanese poetry, obviously more detailed and slightly more fleshed out. And there was, it captured a lot of emotion, I felt. And I also really liked the way that it often captured sort of the myths and legends that you incorporated into the books as well.
I was really deliberate about the poetry that I picked because I wanted it, because I am to a certain extent this kind of reader with American readers where like when you hit like a collection of couplets, you're like, I'm not reading that, and you just skip to the next like prose passage. And so I wanted the poetry that I selected to like, if you skip the poetry, the scene doesn't make sense. And so I was really deliberate about the poetry that I picked because I didn't write any of it. There are some lines in Mirage that Emeni is like composing herself, and those are mine. But the rest of it is all like medieval and pre-Islamic poetry that I then had to translate. But all of it is like selected specifically. Like you can't, like in Court of Lions, you can't skip the poetry that Al-Ras recites and come away from that scene like fully understanding what's going on emotionally in that scene.
That is definitely something about Arabic poetry,
definitely,
in particular, though.
You would definitely have lost out. I think that
it's, whenever I've encountered it, I've always had the sense that it really pierces the heart, if that makes sense. And that's not necessarily mean it's all devastating. It's not. You know, some of it is very, you know, joyful as well, but it encapsulates that human experience. And you know, we made that comparison with, you know, Japanese poetry. I agree with that because there's that fleeting nature to it as well. But while Japanese poetry does sort of tend to focus more on the kind of, it uses a lot of natural visuals to kind of explain what's happening, there's just something very, Arabic poetry just seems to come directly from the heart, if that makes sense.
I think it's like a function of the language, because one of the things I encountered when translating it is that like there's so many ways to translate any particular line that you encounter, but B, there's like a not a slipperiness, but like a metamorphic quality to the language that I think that really encapsulates and really manages to convey those things in ways like, I speak Arabic and I speak English, and that's really the limit of my like linguistic capability. But I do think that like it is a quality that's not unique to Arabic, but that is really well used in the poetry, and that lends itself, like the quality of the language really lends itself to a poetic mode because of the way that the language shifts and turns.
Yeah, it's a musical language. It's also a visually stunning language. And the way that Arabic can be used, Arabic words can be sort of made into artwork as well. I mean that's, again, I only know a very base understanding amount of this from when I studied it, so correct me if any of this is wrong, but one of the big things about the Quran is that it's visually stunning. It's meant to be visually stunning, and these words are beautiful. And when you go into a mosque, or when you go into sort of spaces and you see, I'm friends with an Arabic artist who incorporates a lot of Arabic into her artwork, and it works fantastically. She makes this beautiful jewelry which has Arabic words, and it's just, it really, really works in a way that is very specific to Arabic because of the way there is that fluidity to it. So I just think it's fantastic how you've been able to, even translating it, you know, how you've been able to bring that into a modern novel without losing that real sense of beauty and heritage and depth to it. I think that's fantastic.
It was hard.
I imagine it was, actually, but Madeline's right. The whole idea of it really pierces you to the heart. It felt like that. It wasn't really hiding behind a lot of hyperbole and metaphor, which I think sometimes, I love poetry, but if you look at Western poetry of a certain era, they are really, really concerned with sounding good rather than, I think, conveying something. I mean, it depends on the poet as well. But yeah, I certainly got that. So another thing I wanted to ask you, I could go on for a long time, so we'll have to rein me in a moment, but it's the way that you use the romantic subplots and their interactions with the two main characters sort of forming friendships and things to make them very human. Obviously, we talked about Maren being a very complex character as a result of her birth, but it's this idea that, and I love a really shrewd political player in fiction. That's a character I really enjoy, but a lot of people seem to fall off into the sort of arena where they just make them really cold and analytical and don't give them a warmer human side as well. And I thought the way, particularly in Court of Lions, that Maren and Amani were interacting with Idris, and I'm going to get this name completely wrong, but it's Argras. Yeah. There was one point, and I'm not a crying person. I cannot emphasize that enough. But there was one point where I was genuinely choked up.
I'm just going to say, if you manage to choke up Jules, then that's really something.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Got to say, because romantic subplots are always hit and miss with Jules. Very particular. I'm a massive sucker for them, but okay. Jules is just like, yeah. So if you've hooked her into it, then that's a recommendation onto itself.
I shipped both of them super hard to use the lingo. So.
Oh, yay! Yeah, I it's really interesting to me because one of the things that I've been asked is like, did you put the romance in after? And I'm like a romance first reader. Like there's books that I've been like, you know, I've asked my friends, I'm like, oh, do they kiss? And she's like, no. And I'm like, oh, okay, well, you know, maybe this book's not for me. Like, I'm not really in a place where I can read something that doesn't have a romantic subplot. And so I often, the way that I structure the books is I structure the romance scenes as like carrots. So like if you just have to get to the like the next romance scene and then, you know, you'll enjoy writing it. But also, like, especially with Maram, I really wanted readers to see not just like what a complicated character she was, but also like how difficult it is for her to be vulnerable. That's really what her romance subplot is about, right? Is like about how do you How do you consent to being seen, right? Like, have you guys seen Portrait of a Lady on Fire?
No, I can't say I have.
Oh my goodness. Sounds terrifying.
It's fabulous. No, it's the, oh my goodness, I'm going to get her name wrong. It's the Celine Sciamma French film, the lesbian romance that came out over in February or April. Mm-hmm. It's fantastic, but there's a scene. So the premise is that a female portrait artist is invited onto this French Isle to paint the portrait of a woman who's going to be married to an Italian count or something. But that she cannot allow the subject of her painting to know that she's being painted, and it evolves into this like really beautiful romance. But there's a scene, right, where the subject of the portrait is sitting, and they're talking with one another, and the portrait artist has been painting her for, you know, however long, and she tells her to come stand by her and says, like, what do you think? Oh, the portrait artist is, like, listing all of her tells. So she's like, I can tell when you're happy and I can tell when you're sad. And here are all of the ways how, because I've been watching you for however many days to get this portrait. And the subject calls her over and says, what do you think I'm looking at when you are looking at me, you know? Because they can both tell each other's tells. And I feel like that's really the heart of Maram and Ahras's romance, is that, like, Maram is so used to being misperceived that she's taken it on as a shield for herself, right? And that at this point, like, she's finally encountered someone who actually sees her for who she really is, and who's also willing to continue to see her for who she really is. Mm-hmm. And that is such a rare gift and also a terrifying one, because someone who can see you in your good moments is also someone who can see you at your worst moments. And Maram is hyper conscious of what her worst moments are, because at this point she's orchestrating them on purpose as a self-defense mechanism. And I really wanted readers to be able to see like how difficult it is in general, but also for Maram in particular, to be forced to be seen. And also how liberating it is, right? Because at some point there's a shift change, right? And it becomes something that is like deeply exhilarating and deeply wonderful.
It must also add an extra kind of fear, because if you yourself are going through a stage where your own identity, you're not even sure of who you are supposed to be, and then you get this sense that someone else has kind of almost figured it out, or who sees who you are when you yourself are not able to even acknowledge it yet. That's an intense vulnerability.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's one she wants to reject out of hand, but it's also like so deeply alluring, right? Like that's something you see someone who has kind of figured out who you are, and also what they figured out isn't terrifying to them as she expects it to be. Is something that like she finds deeply engaging and compelling. Yeah,
fantastic.
You'd love it.
Yeah,
you'd love that one, Madeline.
I know. I've got it. I've got it ready. I'm so ready to read this. But
okay, let's move on to sort of around our main topic. We've touched on a lot of aspects of this already through talking about Court of Lions. But let's look at some of the other bits and pieces. So certainly from a Western perspective, it's not really an exaggeration to say that we actually have big gaps in what we're taught about our own history.
Huge.
And some of that is deliberate, and some of that is an accident, and some of it is just a case of sheer misunderstanding because X number of centuries have gone by. Certainly if we're looking at a medieval period, Madeline will know, because I rant about this quite a bit, but the way that women are written out of chronicles, and it was done deliberately by the monks, because even though women were going into battle and taking part in political machinations and things, the monks were kind of like, yeah, but we can't write this down because we can't have people realizing that women do this these sort of things. Everybody knows it, but you need to do a certain amount of reading between the lines. I mean, it was fairly recent that I found out that women didn't just stay at home during the medieval era. Whatever job your husband had was the job you had, or whatever job your father had was the job you trained in, even if you were a girl.
Yeah,
absolutely. And I think it's funny because I wasn't raised in England. I was raised in the Middle East for most of my childhood, in the Middle East and Asia. So I actually learnt a bit about England's colonial history, but also France's colonial history, because I'm also European. So I was learning about all these things when I was abroad. And when I came to England, I was kind of a bit sort of shocked by the fact that it wasn't that people were ignoring it, that most of my classmates literally had no idea. They had absolutely no idea about European colonial history at all, but or just in general, actually, how the world intermixed. And I do remember that just this one bit about having an argument with someone because there was a black person being depicted in Victorian. No, it wasn't even that. It was someone put a black person in Roman England at one point, and they were like, well, no, but they wouldn't have. And I'm like, we have, you realize that they found literal mummies in the north of England. You do realize what the Roman army was made of. They weren't all just white. It was an entire empire. It was ridiculous. People were totally clueless, and it was suddenly like, well, no one existed outside of us until a certain point in history, and trying to put them into our history is wrong. It's like, no, they've always been. We've always had vast amounts of contact with other cultures outside of England. But that history has just disappeared.
One of the things that I find really fascinating is this, like, this completely bonkers idea that, like, Europe and the East's first contact was, like, in the 18th or 19th century.
Yes.
sheer insanity to me. And, you know, my dissertation was about the ways in which, like, the 19th century medieval revival was specifically aimed at, like, attempting to create a homogenous English medieval past where, like, brown people, where, like, people of color didn't exist in an attempt to, like, justify empire. And so one of the things that is really interesting to me is I was reading Maria Rosa Menocal's, I can't remember the name, but it's a book about the ways in which the medieval Arabic literary scene influenced the European medieval literary scene. And she opens the book with this anecdote about how, like, troubadour as a term has, like, stumped etymologists for decades. Like, they're just like, we don't know where this word came from. It doesn't make any sense. It doesn't really have, we, like, can't figure out the roots. There are all of these, like, arguments about it. And then she took an Arabic class, and the Arabic instructor was like, oh yeah, troubadour comes from the Arabic word taraba, which means to sing, and it got imported into Europe from Muslim Spain, which had a thriving literary scene. So, like, the genres that we think of as quintessentially European, like the medieval chivalric romance and the epic poem, were imported from Muslim Iberia into Europe, right, and shaped it in, like, really important ways. But if you tell a Romanist this, they, like, they flip out. They're like, absolutely not. That's ridiculous.
They don't like it, particularly if you...
No.
If you... the other thing is, obviously, that there's a bit of a debate at the moment whether the term Anglo-Saxon is racist or not. And quite honestly, I prefer... You know, I learned Old English, and I prefer to call it Old English because it is essentially a composite of the, you know, the root languages of the English language as we know it today. But calling it Anglo-Saxon was a very deliberate maneuver in the Victorian era, I think. So the whole thing is very uncomfortable, but a lot of people seem to be sort of like, no, you can't take this away from us.
Right, yeah. Yeah.
It's great because they wouldn't have cared otherwise. It's not like they were sitting at home worrying about it before.
Right,
but then
yeah.
Suddenly they're like, no, this is quintessentially, you know, who we are. Like, no, right. Shut up. You've never thought about this a day in your life.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So I teach, I'm actually wrapping up teaching a course on, like, the history of Western fantasy. And one of the ways, like, one of the cornerstones of the course is to think of the world as a map. And there's this great 14th century map called the Catalan Atlas that's, like, the Mediterranean is in the center. And it's got all of these, like, weird roads. And, like, there's, like, a chicken leg in there somewhere. At least it looks like a chicken leg to me. But it's a really great, like, I use it as a metaphor for my students where I'm like, when you look at this map, is there any way in which you can say, like, Europe never interacted with the East? Like, that's patently absurd when you're looking at the map and you see how close, how the Mediterranean ties the world together, this section of the world together, right? And it's one of those things that's really interesting to me where it's like when you put a map in front of someone and you're like, are you telling me that, like, the Maghreb never came up into Spain, or that the Maghrebis in Spain never went up through the rest of Europe, or that, like, Sicily managed to be totally isolated from every other country in the Mediterranean in which it had, like, close trading ties with? It becomes absurd. Like, the more you unpack, like, all of the ways in which, like, unless these people never left their islands and never left their coastlines, of course they've been in contact forever. Like, the classical legacy that, like, Europe prides itself so much on in terms of, like, Greece and Rome came to them through the Arabs, because the Arabs were translating everything. Like, they wouldn't have them, right? Like, we wouldn't be able to say, the West wouldn't be able to say our great democratic tradition that we inherited from the ancient Greeks without the Arabs, because the Arabs translated it for them. Otherwise, it would have been lost, you know, and all of these. So it's always really interesting to me when people say things like, well, there can't be black people in medieval Europe, that's absurd, or medieval England, that's absurd. And it's like, I don't know how to tell you that they've had ships forever.
Yeah, I love it because...
Like, I don't know how to explain this to you. I don't know how to explain, like,
no one gets
facts.
Freaked out. No one argues if we talk about Vikings arriving on the shores. Everyone's like, yeah, that makes sense. But suddenly, if they're coming from another direction, it's, no, that's impossible.
Right. I have to say that the entire argument with Europe not having contact with the Mediterranean has always really annoyed me. I'm a bit of an amateur linguist, so I'm not very good. But looking at things like Proto-Indo-European, you literally could not have all those languages coming up with very, very similar words if they'd never been in contact with each other at all.
you also couldn't have this spread of similar mythology and stories and core concepts. Right. I mean, people have tried to explain it away for so long, and this is, I've talked about Carl Jung and stuff like that, and the whole idea that we all have these archetypes that are inside of us, which are preset. But I think that the more obvious explanation is that you just got to accept that people met other people.
Right.
And these things might have spread.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
So looking at this from the idea of sort of hidden voices in politics and how that's used in fantasy, looking at the base level of, you know, first of all, they erased women and then they erased black people, etc., etc. Obviously, patently, our histories that we are taught them are largely wrong, because there were definitely people pulling strings behind the scenes or, you know, just struggling in order to hold on to enough power to make themselves safe. It was something that struck me with the character of Nadine, who is the stewardess who basically raises Marim, is the fact that, yes, she's a terrible person, and she's got this whole Mother Gothel type vibe, where she's clearly gaslighting this poor girl as she's growing up and teaching her to dislike her own heritage. But at the same time, I can kind of understand how a person like that might have come about in just trying to make themselves safe. She's obviously gone about it in absolutely the wrong way.
Well, with Nadine, you know, you often, or I often hear, like, like, I hear things like, oh, well, like, yeah, you can hate Margaret Thatcher, but also, like, she was a female prime minister, we should respect her for that. Like, you know, that kind of, like, rhetoric. And so Nadine was really, like, all of my resentment at hearing, like, girl boss type rhetoric where you're, like, where women are expected to, like, glorify an imperial form of feminism because, like, women have never, ever gotten to do, like, anything. And so, like, we should take what we can get even if these women are, like, complicit in these, like, horrifying systems of violence, right?
Yeah.
And so, like, for me, Nadine was like, yeah, like, it's super hard for her. But also, like, you make choices. You're an adult and you make choices and you chose to gaslight a child the entirety of her life. You chose to be complicit in a system that, like, disenfranchised an entire planet, right, of their fundamental human rights, right? Like, you chose to be part of that system and you didn't have to be. And so there's a way in which, like, I absolutely wanted to represent that, like, when we're talking about, like, how you write women and how you represent them, like, there's a point in which you have to be honest about the ways in which some women suck. And are willfully complicit in systems of oppression, and, like, being a woman doesn't actually make that any less true, right? Like,
Yeah, definitely.
So, I do think there's, like, a portion, there's, like, a bit of her that is, like, really sympathetic. Like, you learn a little bit more about, like, how she came to be into the position that she was, or, like, what her class standing is, but you also, like, learn about the horrible things that she did to secure her standing within the Vathek government. And that's women, baby. There's, like, you know, there's, like, a wide range. You have, like, Amani, and then and you have Marim, and then you have Nadine. And then you also, like, you learn in Court of Lions, there's also, like, one of the characters, her mother was a collaborator. And so, like, the question of, like, what can we do to survive? But also, like, in what ways does your survival make you complicit? Like, in what way, how far does I need it to survive become, like, how far does that excuse actually go? Is it actually, like, is it actually a justification for doing terrible things and profiting off of those terrible things?
Yeah, definitely. The Margaret Thatcher thing's always bugged me. It's something my mother has occasionally trotted out, you know, I didn't really like her. You know, I didn't like her as a person, but she did great things for women. And I'm like, actually, no, she did great things for Margaret Thatcher. That was the only person she was really concerned about.
Well, there's, like, this weird idea, you know, and I think Margaret Thatcher is, like, really an extension of this, of, like, the difference between women who want parity and equality and women who just want to be able to buy into the system that men benefit from, right? And so, like, I find that, like, anyone, oftentimes when people are like, oh, well, but yeah, it was, like, a great step for women, it's like, oh, okay, you're not actually interested in, like, dismantling systems of oppression. You want to be part of the the old boys club. Like, that's what's happening. And so you see this person as, like, a representation of, like, if you just do enough things right or wrong, they'll let you in. And then you can start stealing milk from children.
Yeah.
Sorry, thank you so much.
Well, okay, you're both laughing, but the thing is, I would have been about 2 years old, but I do have vague memories of this being in the papers or on the news.
Oh, God. You know, I shouldn't laugh, because, you know, over here on this side of the Atlantic, we're really not much worse. We're really not much better.
No, I'm not laughing because it's funny. I'm laughing just because everything that you've just said has just filled me with such joy that it burst out of me.
No, I absolutely agree. You guys are probably too young to remember Spitting Image, but it was basically caricature puppets that were particularly of political leaders, and it was largely aired over here in the 80s and very early 90s. I think it got banned in the end. They always showed Margaret Thatcher going into the men's bathroom and using a urinal rather than for example. So they were clearly making the same point that this is someone who's buying into the patriarchy as it stands rather than...
Right.
Yeah.
Anyway, sorry about that little aside, but let's look at... okay, in terms of speculative fiction, what makes political intrigue and political change so fascinating to deal with in fantasy and science fiction?
You're going to get a much, like, lowbrow answer probably than you were expecting. I just like court poll. Like, I like court politics and I like intrigue because I think when I was younger and a less ambitious writer, I often thought of court intrigue as, like, a chess game, which sucks because I don't know how to play chess. I find that it is, like, several levels above what I'm willing to commit brain-wise to a game. But then someone that I was talking to was like, well, court politics isn't chess, it's relationships, right? Like, it's how relationships cause conflict and how people's desires are often at odds with one another. And so thinking of, like, a court political map as really, like, a relationship tree made it way more interesting, because that's the thing that I'm interested in when I'm writing is the relationships. But I also, it feels like you're, like, more what you're asking is, like, maybe about how colonialism and imperialism come to bear on the genre.
Yeah, I mean, it was a very open question. I think it's something that it's definitely something I look for in fantasy, and yeah, I like your battles and your Helm's Deep moments and everything, but at the same time I find that they've been imitated a lot, certainly in high fantasy and science fiction as well, to the point where they've sort of lost a bit of meaning. So a really good court intrigue gets me on board far more than endless battle scenes will.
You know, I'm exactly the same. I can't read battle scenes, and I also, part of it is, part of my limitations as a writer is, like, I can't write battle scenes because I don't think that they're interesting. Like, I got with Mirage, there were a couple of reviews from readers who were like, where are all of the action scenes? And I was like, dude, you're reading the wrong book. you've come to the wrong writer. I think that they can be visually interesting. Like, I love an X-Wing dogfight in Star Wars. And Helm's Deep is, like, one of my favorite things in the Two Towers, but I just, like, that's not where my interest lies as a writer. My interest lies in relationships. And there's a way in which, obviously, relationships can come to bear on a battlefield. But I'm way more interested in watching that play out in a courtroom and play out through dialogue and, like, unpacking the subtleties of a relationship through language. That's just way more interesting to me. And then thinking about how those conversations and those relationships then have ripple effects in terms of government and politics. That was the thing that was, like, really fun about Court of Lions, was getting to build out the ways in which the relationships Emeni was building in that book would affect the revolution and affect the rebellion and affect how these women were going to come together and how they related to one another. Like, she really becomes a lightning rod for all of these women who would never have spoken to one another and never have come together to finally be able to stand side by side. And so for me, that was always like the driving force. And that's all, that's sort of always the driving force when I'm writing, is thinking about how people's relationships change over the course of a novel, and how they fracture and come back together. And that I think for me, that's like a more engaging literary experience. Like, I dread any time I have to write any sort of battle scene or any sort of fight scene. Yeah. Just because I'm sort of like, I think in D&D terms. So I'm like, okay, so you take 10 damage and then you take 15
damage. Yes.
Yeah. I think it's funny what you were saying, that, you know, I can see why some people who basically, they just want something that starts with a frenetic pace and never lets go, might right. find that something like Mirage kind of bypasses them a little bit. But yeah. I have to say, having got to a certain point in Court of Lions where
yeah.
certain people were offering loyalty to other certain people, I'm trying to be yes. very oblique, my heart was pounding. I was kind of like, this is the same sort of reaction I would get out of a battle scene. So obviously it depends how you're wired as a reader and as a writer as well, yeah. but there is definitely action. It's just, I think some people don't really appreciate internal action, the internal emotional yeah. journey as much.
Mm. Yeah.
It's funny because I think that human psychology and the psychology of relationships and the way that relationships affect the world around us is actually so important. Because, I mean, again, let's just looking at the English, the British government right now, it's all people who all know each other. You know, they all went to school together, they've all got something together.
Right.
But it's yeah. also, you get court politics in the playground, really, if you think about it on a much smaller scale. It's something which is completely hardwired into our brains because we're social creatures. And so I think it makes sense that that would be the center of a story, and that rather than it just being, oh, well, you know, we avoid them, those kinds of people, if you add high stakes, of course it's going to be interesting. And I think because it's relatable in that way,
right.
You can get sort of heart-pounding moments because you understand those stakes in some ways, but you also understand the psychology of what's happening, and you're engaging with people and it makes them real, and so you feel like you're part of it. Whereas there can be quite something quite distant when you're yeah. writing a battle scene or you're reading a battle scene. I'm the same. I love watching them, but reading them can be quite difficult because suddenly I can't imagine yeah. what's happening. It's really, really difficult.
Right. You know, one of the most affecting battle scenes I've ever read, and I'm going to reveal how deeply a nerd I am, but it's the fifth battle in the Silmarillion where yeah. Thingon dies. And it's like three lines where Tolkien outlines how, like, he gets beaten to death by a group of Balrogs. And it's like my favorite violent action in a book ever. But it's also literally three lines, or like, I think it's like one line. I think it's like, and they beat him and dragged his banner through the blood or something like that. But it's like a really visual scene of like his battle, the banner of his house that he's been carrying gets dragged through like muddy blood after he's dead. But again, also yeah. it's only three lines. And I think that some of these battle scenes, like it's hard for me to like even be able to track like troop movements. Like I was reading an article about the fifth battle and it was like, it's a pincer move. And I was like, it's a pincer move? What?
Yeah, it's actually funny because obviously the Lord of the Rings films, I swear you spend like 50% of the time in battle. The books, it's like a few pages and then yes. now we're going to look at the aftermath of the battle. And you're like, wait, what happened?
Right, well, The books are all relationships, and I think that's why, like, I'm a person, I like the Silmarillion more than Lord of the Rings because I'm a girl who loves chronicles, and I love, like, world building, and the Silmarillion is just, like, yeah. one long codex, but it's also, like, it's also literally just relationships, and it's written in a really dry way, but, like, once I started thinking about it as a text that was about the ways in which all of these relationships that should have lasted into eternity fractured again and again and again, it became way more interesting to me. And I think that's really, like, for me, that's the pull of it, is thinking about all of these people that are semi-related, that, like, through one stupid action end up destroying each other. made it super interesting.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we're coming towards the end, but before we get there, perhaps you'd like to go first, Samir. I'll put you on the spot. Who would be your favourite fictional character in sci-fi and fantasy of sort of a female political player?
Ooh, a female political player. Okay, so Harrow from Gideon the Ninth. Have you guys read Gideon the Ninth?
Yes. I loved Gideon the Ninth. Yeah.
Gideon is actually my favorite character, but she's very much not a political player. So
she's not at all.
Harrow.
No. It's brute force and ignorance, isn't it?
Yeah. So I'll pick Harrow because she's a much more shrewd political player.
Yeah, that is a good one. I must get on and read the arc I've got of Harry the Ninth, actually.
God, it's so good. It's like one of those things where you're like, there's no way that she could beat Gideon, and then Harrow was like a technical marvel of writing.
Well, now I have to read it, so.
Yes.
I've got a few. I suppose I've got a childhood love of Princess Leia, even though she's not that complicated a character, but she is far more competent, and I keep saying this, than any of the men on the screen at any one time.
She really is.
Yes.
I'm very fond of Dune, despite, you know, there are parts of it that don't really resonate quite so well now, but I really like Jessica and Alia, and I like Helena Gaius Moim, the Mother Superior as well, who, again, is a horrible, terrible person, but driven by her own specific goals, and they're all really interesting political players as well.
Yeah.
I think there are a few characters in the Game of Thrones books who sort of start to tick it, but then kind of mess up. I certainly think there are quite a few very interesting sort of female characters. I mean, the sand snakes in the actual book seem to actually be quite shrewd in what's going on, and certainly you've got Sansa has been quite shrewd a few times. I think my favourite, and Jules is going to tell me off, and she's going to say that it's not, but honestly, the only one that really came to mind when I thought of shrewd political player was Eleanor from The King's Knight. I know she doesn't spend that much time in politics, but I'm sorry, Jules. I'm sorry.
She does influence her husband, I'll give you that. Sorry.
She influences her husband, and I'm pretty sure it's only her and her friendship with the Queen which prevents Gregory Maudsley from getting executed while he's lying on his sickbed. So I'm going to call that a political player, and I'm just going to say big tick on that one. Because I'm pretty... Well, let's just say that without her, everybody would have died. Literally everybody. All of them dead. So there we go. That's my contribution.
Have to go away and think about that one. Right, well, this has been really fascinating. Thank you so much for joining us, Samir. So just so that our readers know where to find you, do you have a website, Twitter, etc.
So you can find me on my website at sumeyabooks.com and on Twitter as Sumeya Dawood, and then on Instagram as Sumeya with three I's, which I should change at some point to just my name, but you know.
Fantastic.
Yeah. And Court of Lions is out, is it 4th of August?
Yeah, August 4th, 2020. 2 weeks.
2 weeks. So... Well, it might well be out when this one airs. So if it is, go and get it. If it's not out, go and pre-order it. And if you haven't got Mirage, pre-order, well, go and buy that as well. Because you cannot go wrong with these two books, definitely.
Yeah, absolutely. Fantastic. Well, we're going to say thanks very much for listening, guys. Thanks very much for coming onto the show, Samir.
Thanks so much for having me.
And we'll catch you guys next week.
Yeah, thanks and goodbye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note, no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.